Okay, so let's see this, what we've got. We're linking text with themes here and seeing where we go. Rebecca, start with you.
One of your says, from whom we do exist, it seems to be here, ready to speak on my parental care.
Yeah.
So it shows, like, a thought around, like, the parent
to
children relationship.
Okay.
And, like, represents the ratio.
In what way?
Like, showing that who he sees to be.
Right.
And that, it, like, she should kind of, like, respect that.
Okay. All right. There's an irony here, isn't there? Because he starts with, by the sacred radiance of the sun, the mystery of the hecat, and the night, by all the operation of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be. He kind of puts himself into the context of the kind of universal great chain of being. He understands that his authority comes from, or he believes that his authority comes from the gods. And you notice all those things that he talks about, they're linked to that telemic view of the world, the radiance of the sun, the operation of the orbs. The orbs are the planets, the moons, the stars, and all those things. Did I just steal your point, Sophia? Did I just steal your point? I'm sorry. I do apologise. So, it links to that. What were you going to say? Go, Sophia, go to you there.
Alright, I was
going to
say it links to destiny as well.
Good.
And it's because he's doing like such a terrible thing, it could be that because he's like referencing geocentric.
Yeah. Brilliant, absolutely right. Links to destiny, the geocentric view of the world, he's leaving it to destiny, he's leaving it to us. That's really, really good. It's exactly right. And a really nice link to context too. The irony, of course, is that having put himself in that context of what would be understood as the great chain of being, he then, in the very next sentence, disclaim all my paternal care. And that word paternal there is actually loaded with significance, because obviously paternal means fatherly, and what he's doing is letting his daughter go. He's banishing his daughter, so he is relinquishing his paternal care. But as a king, there's also the image there of him being father of the nation, and his role as king would be expected to be paternal in terms of looking after his kingdom. Both in terms of disciplining when discipline's needed, but also care when care is needed. And so the irony is that having put himself into the great chain of being and kind of taken his authority in that sense from the great chain of being, he then deliberately kind of perverts the great chain of being by relinquishing the very thing that he should be as king, which is paternal. He should be paternal both to his daughter and to his kingdom, and he's neither. And, okay, I'm taking over, I'll let you talk, sorry. Sarah, what have you got to add?
I put, with metal daughters, there is digest a third.
Yeah.
This is foolishness, like a simple mistake, and it's going against nature.
Good. What, in what ways are going against nature? You're right.
Because he shouldn't be giving his land away.
Yeah.
He shouldn't. But he's going against the great chain of being, really. He's giving away his responsibility.
Absolutely. That act is exactly doing that, going against nature, the great chain of being. Digest the third. Of course, what he's doing is he's intended to divide the kingdom into three, and he's ending up dividing it into two and splitting the third part between the other two. So they split it directly in two. Okay, good. Let's see what else we've got. Let's go back. Megan, what have we got?
I don't really know what I was trying to say, but I said about the propinquity,
yeah,
and the property of blood.
Yeah.
Saying about the humours and
like good.
They're talking about the relationship, the blood relationship, and I don't really know what I was trying to say.
No, I know, I see exactly what you're getting at. It's kind of linked to that idea of disclaiming all my paternal care, propinquity and property of blood. What he's trying to do is disclaim, he's trying to cut off his blood relationship, his familial family relationship with his daughter. Now we know from the discussion we had about authority that the king's word is law, so if the king says it, it happens. But what he's doing here is deeply unnatural, isn't it? To cut off the property of blood and the propinquity and property of blood. He's trying to cut off something that's kind of written in blood. And you're right, he does link to the humours. And links that idea of an imbalance of the humours there. I wouldn't make too much of that context there, because I think that works more in the case of madness, but you could certainly mention it in passing at that point in an essay. What I wouldn't do at that point in an essay, we're talking about that, is going for long explanations of the humours and how the imbalance causes madness, because it'd take you off track. But what you can kind of mention in passing that he seems to imbalance the humours at that point, or the understanding of the humours at that point. Good, really good. It's deeply unnatural what he's doing there, but it seems. Good. Hannah, what else? Absolutely. Very good. The difference between Kent and Lear here is so marked, isn't it? Lear is aggressive, and he's unbelievably hasty in his judgments. Rash is a good word. He's very rash. He makes decisions quickly without thinking them through. He seems to be deliberately perverting the great chain of being. But Kent seems the very opposite. Royal Lear, whom I have ever honoured as my king, loved as my father, as my master followed, as my great patron thought on in my prayers. We didn't quite get to that as we read it, but it is absolutely the definition of the great chain of being. He's his king, his father, his master, and he's prayed for him. Everything that the king should be and everything that the king is not being at that moment of the play. Really good. Yes, Elaine.
To contrast that, could you say about the line above it where they say it, revenue, execution of the rest, beloved servant be yours, which to confirm.
Yeah.
So it's like he's given away all of his land and everything, but he wants to keep the pleasures for himself.
Absolutely.
By giving everything away, he's going against the great chain of being and the divine realm, I think.
That's exactly right. He gives away, it's just at the bottom of the previous page, he gives away power, preeminence. Preeminence is his position as king. If you're king, you're preeminent, the most important. So he gives power, preeminence, and all the large effects that treat his majesty. So he gives away all of his responsibilities and his power, and then over the page, only we shall retain the name and all the addition to a king. So all he keeps is the name and the addition, that is the perks of the job. And he repeats it again, I'm giving away the sway, revenue, execution of the rest, beloved son, be yours. So all of the power, all of the decision-making and responsibilities he's given away, he just wants the name. Which is why when he later says, which of you can tell me who I am, the fool says, Lear's shadow. Because that's exactly what he's done, really, isn't he? He's kept the shadow, he's kept the shape of a king, but he's given away the substance of a king. The fool later on uses the image of an egg. He says, you're like an eggshell. You've kept the shape, you've kept the name, but you've given the meat of the egg, the substance of the egg away. And we see that exactly here. Okay, were you going to say something? No, okay. Really good. Okay, Lauren.
Can you say
that's
the gods again being directly involved in human
relations? Absolutely, really good. So it links to that image of the gods. Lear believes his authority and his power comes directly from the gods. Line about 108. Good. Okay. Danielle, what else have you got?
Where it says here I display my maternal care, yeah. I said about the marking there being the authority.
Okay.
Like you draw the authority to be stable rather than moral, so we banish it as an
adult. And that's a really good point. You'd rather authority be stable than moral. It's interesting to think, and there are no rights and wrongs here because it's not in any way clear, deliberately ambiguous probably, but his motivation behind what he does, is it simply personal anger at his daughter for failing to flatter him? Or is it, as Danielle suggests, a more kind of Machiavellian view that I'm not having anyone in my court who deliberately disobeys me, so I'm getting rid and I'm showing who's boss? That would be the other view of that. And we don't know, and Shakespeare doesn't give us any clues. He's, of course, they're not real people, they're Shakespeare's creations, and clearly it's not terribly important for Shakespeare at that moment that we understand why Lear banishes Cordelia, simply that he does. It's certainly seen as foolish, I think, but it definitely links to that. It's a good link, a really good link. Because he does the same with Kent, doesn't he? Anybody who stands up to him, anybody who threatens his authority or who questions his authority, he banishes. And that is very Machiavellian. That's stability is more important than anything else. Good. Okay, Alex.
I think it's
really
similar to what Beck is it, but when Kent tries to step in,
yeah.
He replies, "Come not between the dragon and his wolf."
Yeah.
So again, there's like emphasising that he believes the one who do it, like even though it's unnatural.
Right. It's a really interesting image. Does anybody else pick out the dragon and his wrath image for you? Speak about it. No, it's really an important image. It's so important. They did a little drawing of a dragon in the text. it's an important image, that one. Come not between the dragon and his wrath. If you think about what a dragon represents, it represents a kind of animalistic, aggressive, anger, fire-breathing monster. And what Lear is doing is likening himself to a dragon. Come not between me and my anger is what he means, but what he says is come not between a dragon and his wrath. It's a kind of admission by Lear, although he doesn't, you know, I'm not suggesting Shakespeare is trying to make us believe that Lear means to admit it. But Shakespeare puts these words into Lear's mouth to kind of show what's happened to Lear and the decision-making that Lear is making here. This is not decision-making based on paternal care of a king, the fatherly concern for his daughter or for his people. This is a dragon acting in an animalistic, self-defensive, aggressive kind of way. He is the very opposite of what a king should be at that moment. There is a sense of destiny about that, but the destiny, I think, interestingly, it comes from this idea that the king believes that what he says goes. And he's kind of creating his own sense of destiny almost here, although he's called upon the authority of the moon, the stars, and the gods. But his utter sense of what I say goes, come not between the dragon and his wrath. Later on, to Kent, he uses a different image. He says, the bow is bent. Let's find the exact quote. The bow is bent and drawn, make from the shaft. In other words, I've made my decision. It's a bow and arrow image. So he's pulled the bow back with the arrow in it. And there's nothing you can do to stop this now. So just get out of the way. And Kent says, well, let the arrow fall, let go of the arrow and let it fall before you fire it. But it's too late, Lear says. Okay. Good. Really good. Keely.
You know, when he, when he talks about the olives, he's putting blame on them and not taking control of his own destiny.
Good. It directly links that idea, as we said, about that idea of destiny. It's an interesting ambiguity, isn't it? In a sense, he says, look, I've made my decision. The bow is bent, come not between the dragon and his wrath. Decisions have been made. And at the same time, there seems to be that sense of giving, of assuming the destiny is made for him by the sun and the stars and the gods. It's an interesting ambiguity. Right, Andrew.
It's a pretty weak point, but let pride, which he calls plainness, marry her.
Yeah.
I suppose you could link that to destiny as he himself is letting her. He's washing his hands of her, so to speak. Yeah. And also, in a more minuscule way, in the great chain of being, it was the father's responsibility to find a husband
for
his
wife. Yeah.
For his daughter, sorry. And he is sort of giving her control over her destiny, which goes against.
Chain of being, yeah, okay. Let pride be a dower. Sorry. Where was the quote?
I lost myself now.
Let pride, which equals plainness, marry her. And then earlier on she says, Let truth be thy dower, that's line 107, top of the page. It's interesting, isn't it? When we think about a tragedy and we think about pride or hubris, what do we normally think about? Who talked about pride?
Aristotle.
Do I need to go back over that? We did it the other day. Some of you were in my year 12 class and I went over it for the first time with them. Do I need to go back over Aristotle's theory of tragedy? Yeah? That's okay. Well, we'll do that in a minute. Let's just finish this point. Pride. Hubris is associated as the hamartia, the tragic flaw of the tragic hero in Aristotle's work. It's interesting that Lear turns to Cordelia and says, let pride, which she calls plainness, marry her. He accuses Cordelia of being proud. The great irony, I think, is that as an audience we look on and actually it's Lear's pride here that's standing in the way. It's an interesting one because critics have argued about this as to how much Cordelia's decision-making here is based on pride. How much is does she not speak because she's too proud to humble herself in front of her father? Or how much is it, to use the quote earlier on, a matter of truth that stands in the way? Does she not want to lie? She wants to be truthful. Because she says, so young my lord and true, and he says, let it be so, thy truth then be thy dower. And that comes back to this idea of truth and honesty, of kind of wisdom, foolishness, links into all of that. The suggestion from Lear then, let truth then be thy dower, is that truth is less important than obedience. I ask you to tell me how much you love me, and you're telling me the truth. I don't want to hear the truth, I don't want to hear you tell me how much you love me. It's line 108, right at the start of that bit we just looked at. It's, let it be so, thy truth then be thy dower. Lear seems to prize obedience over truth, or flattery over truth, at this moment in the play.
Dower meaning?
A dower is the payment that a father would give alongside his daughter to a husband. It's kind of slightly horrific way that relationships happen, particularly in this kind of class, the upper classes. A husband, a father would give with her daughter, I think I described it earlier as a sweetener, a kind of some money to the husband and say, look, please take her off my hands. And that was called dowry. I might be being slightly unkind about the idea, but that's basically what it means. And so for some people, dowry might be some money. Fathers would save. We talk now, and it's funny, it's because it all tracks in, we talk now about fathers saving early on for their daughters' weddings, because weddings are expensive things, so fathers in particular, or parents, save money, so when their daughter turns around and says, I'm going to get married, they've got some money to be able to pay for the wedding. That kind of tradition came from much further back. The idea that the bride's family, the wife's family pays for the wedding comes from this idea of a dowry. That we'll pay for the wedding and we'll give you a dowry, so it's some money or some jewels or something alongside it to kind of make it worth your while. So you choose our daughter, not another one. It shows you the complete gender imbalance of the time. And it's funny, we hang on to all these things and they're kind of, we just kind of take them for granted, romantic, you know, a wife's parents pay for the wedding or a bride. But actually the origins of that tradition are pretty horrific, really, you think it through. And I suppose more and more people aren't doing that. We didn't. We split it three ways. My parents, my parents, we paid for a third of it, so it's kind of fair. But there was still my wife's family still felt that, her father still felt that expectation that he needed to be paying for his daughter's wedding. We had to persuade him quite hard that we would pay for a third of it. Too hard, it turned out, because he said yes. right. Okay. Anything else in this passage? Right, let me go over very quickly the great chain of being with you. Are you? Not the great chain of being, sorry. Aristotle's. Where did this begin to the other day, didn't I?
No,
sorry. I tell you what, rather than going through it now and doing this in class, if I put on the website, which I've just about got set up now, just a sheet, a reminder sheet, because I've got it written out somewhere, of the different ideas, then I think it will... you'll remember it well enough. Is that alright?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're still stuck, come and find me and we'll go through it.
Yeah,
I can do that. Most definitely need to do that. Right, okay, so let's move on a bit. And I want to turn to Edmund. At one scene two. No, you got Mrs. Smith, thanks. I've got year 9. I kind of wish you had a double now, but I'm probably good. Let's have a look at page 12, Act 1, Scene 2. I'm always conscious of this. I'm an old-fashioned literature teacher at heart, and I kind of feel like I should go through every page of the text with you. But it just simply isn't possible to do that. So, I'm not suggesting that the lines in between what we just looked at and this aren't important. They absolutely are. We deal with France and Burgundy and France choosing Cordelia not because of her dowry, not because she's lost her dowry, but because she is who she is. And there are some useful lines in there. But Act 1, Scene 2, Edmund is a really important bit. So we'll finish by having a look at this, spending 5 minutes looking at it and then 5 minutes feeding back. I'll read it to you quickly. This is a soliloquy. So this is Edmund talking to the audience so that we understand his feelings and his thoughts. He says, "Thou, nature, art my goddess. To thy law my services are bound. Wherefore should I stand in the plague of custom and permit the curiosity of nations to deprive me, for that I am some 12 or 14 moonshines lag of a brother? Why, bastard, wherefore base? When my dimensions are as well compact, my mind as generous, and my shape as true as honest madam's issue. Why brand they us with baseness, bastardy, base, who in the lusty stealth of nature take more composition and fierce quality than doth within a dull, stale, tired bed, go to the creating a whole tribe of fox, got between asleep and wake. Well then, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land. Our father's love is to the bastard Edmund as to the legitimate." Fine word, legitimate. "Well, my legitimate, if this letter speed and my invention thrive, Edmund the base shall top the legitimate. I grow, I prosper. Now gods, stand up for bastards." It's a good line.
That's good.
That's Act 2, Act 1, Scene 2, page 12. Right, so, same again, it shouldn't take us long, a couple of minutes, 3 or 4 minutes to go through that. As well as trying to pick out how it links to themes, have a look at language as well in there, AO2. Remind me, we've got to go back over and look at pentameter, don't let me forget that. Have a look, though, at the language of that speech, that soliloquy as well, and how Shakespeare's achieving that effect. Andrew said it sounds, would you say, passionate? How does he get that passion across? Right, a couple of minutes. Okay, so let's have a quick look at this. Themes that passage links to. Just have hands up. It's time to go, Andrew.
I know I'm jumping straight to the back, but it's I grow up, I prosper, now God stand up for bastards. it's sort of a challenge towards the God, so to speak. It is him openly denying the great chain of evil.
Okay, that's excellent. It is a challenge to the gods. I grow, I prosper, now God, stand up for bastards. It's kind of a rallying cry. Will gods be on my side? This is what I'm about. Gods, what are you about? Are you prepared to stand up for me? It is a direct challenge to that view of the great chain of being that he talks about earlier on. Good. What else? Go on, Elena.
And when he says, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land, it's as if he's trying to change his own destiny.
Good.
He's supposed to get nothing.
Good.
But he wants to flip it.
Absolutely. It's that view of destiny and nature, in a sense, isn't it? It's kind of a Machiavellian view. You take charge of your own destiny. Notice how many times he uses the pronoun I. I must have your land. I grow. I prosper. That forceful use of the pronoun I. I'm putting myself in the centre here. I'm putting myself, and God, if you want to be on my side, then do. But if you don't, I'm still going to do it anyway. That's the clear suggestion. And it's an absolute challenge to the orthodox view of the universe and of life and of destiny, great chain of being, all of those things. Good. What else? Sophia?
I don't know. I don't have anything else.
Okay, that's right. Go on, Alan.
I'm not a direct quote, but throughout it, he's a threat to the established order.
Yes.
He's illegitimate and he wants to gain power.
Absolutely. He is a threat to the established order because he's illegitimate and he wants to gain more power. That's exactly right. He is, and it's difficult for us to comprehend quite how much of a threat he would be to an audience in Elizabethan time. This idea that somebody is prepared to challenge the established order. Remember, Renaissance is a time of questioning, it's a time of challenge, but it's also a time of great insecurity because of that. And, you know, at a time when things are challenged, there's also a kind of reaction to that, to want things to stay the same. We see it all the way through our culture at the moment. If you step back and look at it, we're living through a time of incredible change. The technology driven, but it's hugely changing our culture, our society, the way we interact with the world around us, each other. Our view of the world has changed enormously in the last 20 years. But at the same time, there's this kind of counter reaction of wanting things to stay the same and look back how it used to be. And kind of Daily Mail readers will know all about it, that kind of conservative reactionary, you know, this is awful, this change is awful, we want things to be the way they were when we were growing up, kind of reaction. And so for Shakespeare's audience, Edmund, whilst he might kind of echo some of the challenges and some of the thoughts of Renaissance thinking, he also represents a real threat to that established order. He's illegitimate. Everybody knows that illegitimate children are an embarrassing detail to be forgotten and kept hidden. And here he is saying, no, I'm illegitimate and I am as good as worthy as my legitimate brother. And if the system won't give me my land and my power, then I'm going to take it for myself. I grow, I prosper. You notice, I'm sure, the alliterative effect of the repetition of be, of bastard, base. They're all plosive sounds. Remember from last year, plosive, P-L-O-S-I-V-E, plosive sounds. We've got lots of B's and D's through that. With base, with baseness, bastardy, base. He says, and of course that just adds to that anger and that passion, doesn't it? It creates that sense, that kind of aggression that he speaks there. And the question is, the speech is made up really of rhetorical questions, one after another. Wherefore, why? And it's not until the last section, last third, that he turns the questions around to answers. And his questions are good questions. Why should I be less than my brother, simply because when I was conceived, it was a couple of moonshines, a couple of months outside of marriage, before marriage. Why does that make life any different? And he actually somewhat kind of, it's almost comedy, although in the context of the speech it's not, says, well, surely somebody conceived in the height of passion of an affair should have more about them than somebody who's conceived in a dull, stale, tired marriage. Got betwixt wake and sleep. I'll let you fill in the gaps there. But, you know, why should somebody who's conceived in the passion of an affair be less than somebody who was conceived in a dull, tired, stale bed? So he says, and of course he calls on nature. And his view of nature is the nature that stands up for the strongest, for the most intelligent, for the bravest, not the nature of the great chain of being, of the orthodox nature that is defined by God and by the universe.
Where he says our fathers love us to the best of it, and yeah, to be what did you say, like, about it being like the normal parent-children relationship, almost as if he's like a child, like he's desperate for his father's love.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he's desperate for his father's love. It certainly keys into that the parent-child thing, but he's not desperate for his father's love. What he actually says is, look, my father loves me as much as he loves him. It's another reason why we're the same. We're the same because I'm as strong, because I'm as intelligent, I'm as worthy, and I'm as strong because my father loves me just as much as he loves Edgar. The only thing that's stopping me getting my equal share of my father's inheritance is because I'm illegitimate. And why on earth, he says, should that be? He's got a point, doesn't he? Got a point. Right, thank you.